But in more importantly, I would urge his voters to read my
Could be the first book he's read in years.
Yes. And, no, I was going to say, I would actually more so urge his voters to read my book so they can realize actually that his policies are harming them. And the only reason why they're connected to him is because of the racist ideas he manipulates them with.
Ibram X. Kendi, author of the new book, How to Be an Anti-Racist. He's speaking in Brooklyn at the Community Bookstore at Congregation Beth Elohim tonight. A conversation with activist Sean King. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Feminist Film Night and Planned Parenthood fundraiser on Friday, August 16th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. This Planned Parenthood fundraiser will screen A Girl Like Her, which tells the hidden history of over a million young women who became pregnant in the 1950s and 60s and were banished to maternity homes to give birth and surrender their babies for adoption. And Jane, an Abortion Service, a documentary of Jane. The Chicago-based women's health group performed nearly 12,000 safe illegal abortions between 1969 and 1973. There will be a conversation after the films between a former Jane, Judith Arcana, and a girl like her, Lonnie Jo Lee. Again, that's the Feminist Film Night and Planned Parenthood fundraiser on Friday, August 16th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Bonds Over Borders on Tuesday, August 27th at 6 p.m. at the Cleaners at Ace Hotel in Portland. Bonds Over Borders is a benefit for Innovation Law Lab, a Portland-based organization that works to increase legal access for immigrants at detention centers, both locally and around the country. There will be live stand-up sets from Adam Passy and Dan Weber, and live music by Pedro Queriega. Again, that's Bonds Over Borders on Tuesday, August 27th at 6 p.m. at the Cleaners at Ace Hotel, 403 Southwest 10th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good evening. It's 5:02, and you're listening to KBOO Portland. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Portland Saturday Market. 46 years of American-made arts and crafts, freshly prepared international foods, local artisans, and local music in downtown Portland. Open every Saturday and Sunday in Waterfront Park, now through Christmas Eve. Event schedule, vendor information, and more at PortlandSaturdayMarket.com. And now stay tuned for your KBOO Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon joins a lawsuit opposing the merger between T-Mobile and Sprint.
President Trump delays new tariffs on Chinese goods in time for holiday shopping.
And in international news, Alejandro Giammatte has been elected president of Guatemala.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, August 13th, 2019. I'm Leslie McLam.
And I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Oregon has joined a multi-state lawsuit to block the T-Mobile-Sprint merger. Oregon Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum announced on Monday that Oregon would join the lawsuit to block the merger of telecommunications companies T-Mobile and Sprint. Oregon is the 16th state to join the lawsuit, which is led by New York Attorney General Letitia James. Regulators approved the $26 billion merger in late July. Rosenblum said, quote, "It's important that Oregon join other states in opposing the Sprint-T-Mobile merger. If left unchallenged, the current plan will result in reduced access to affordable wireless service in Oregon and higher prices. Neither is acceptable."
A top lawyer with the Oregon Department of Justice has released a legal opinion that runs contrary to the state legislature's promises regarding a new death penalty law passed earlier this year. The new law Senate Bill 1013 significantly limits the crimes eligible for the death penalty in Oregon. Lawmakers insisted that the bill would not affect past death row cases and said these cases would not be returned to lower courts for retrials or new sentence hearings. Oregon's Solicitor General, Benjamin Gutman, disagrees. Gutman told prosecutors in an email distributed by the Oregonian that the law does in fact apply to those cases, including pending aggravated murder charges. The new law narrows the definition of aggravated murder, which is currently the only charge in the state that is eligible for the death sentence. Gutman's opinion could open the door for appeals from people on death row, despite the legislature's intent.
Sarah Boone has been sworn in as the chief of Portland Fire and Rescue. Boone is the first female African-American fire chief for the city of Portland. Boone graduated from Lincoln High School and later joined the Fire Bureau's apprenticeship program. She was the Bureau's first female African-American firefighter when she joined in 1995, and also the first to be promoted to battalion chief in 2014. Fire Chief Boone told a large crowd at her swearing-in ceremony that her number one priority is ensuring the safety of everyone who calls Portland home. Boone said, quote, "My position is not a position of power, but a platform of support. Courage and strength, care and compassion are not qualities worn on our shoulders and sleeves like rank. They are not part of this uniform that we take off when our shift ends. These values are the foundation of who we are as a department, a city, and a nation."
Yesterday, Governor Kate Brown signed a bill freeing chickens from cages. Senate Bill 1019 requires commercial farms with more than 3,000 chickens to be cage-free. The bill also prevents the purchase or sale of caged eggs. Starting in 2024, large farms will also be required to provide enrichment for hens, including scratching areas and dust baths. The law relates to the bills recently passed in Washington State and California. According to the Humane Society, the U.S. West Coast now has the strongest laws protecting chickens in the world. Josh Balk, the vice president of the Farm Animal Protection Division of the Humane Society, says this change reflects on the consumers' views as well. Balk said, quote, "Everyday Oregonians don't want animals to be abused, to suffer, and this law, more than any other law in the history of the state, improves the treatment of farm animals."
The Oregon Food Bank has released a statement in response to the Trump administration's public charge rule. The controversial public charge regulation would punish legal immigrants if they receive food assistance through the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, or SNAP, by jeopardizing their ability to stay in the United States, even if they are qualified and eligible for SNAP benefits. Susanna Morgan, CEO of the Oregon Food Bank, released a statement saying, quote, "We simply reject the administration's efforts to criminalize immigrants. No family should have to decide between putting food on the table and securing long-term stability for themselves and their children. But that's what will happen if this new rule from the Department of Homeland Security becomes law. This rule is just the latest in a series of attacks from this administration on immigrants of color and people experiencing hunger and poverty. It would penalize people that utilize nutrition programs and other services that strengthen and support families and communities." Similarly, the Aware Food Bank in Woodburn released a statement saying, quote, "Aware is here to serve and be a part of the whole community. Folks should be able to come here without fear, knowing that they will be treated well. But the current levels of fear experienced by immigrant communities means that folks who need food assistance don't feel safe getting it."
And now it's time for Labor History in 2 from host Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1892. That was the day miners in Tracy City, Tennessee, rebelled against the state's convict lease system. Miners had been forced to work side by side with convict labor. The convicts, overwhelmingly African American, were forced to live in deplorable stockade conditions. Their presence in the mines served to minimize paid labor, keep wages low, and stunt union organizing throughout the state. Miners demanded that Tennessee Coal, Iron, and Railroad give them the same hours of work as the convicts. When they refused, the miners marched on the stockades where the convicts were housed. They released the convicts and marched them onto trains bound for Nashville, burning the stockades to the ground. The revolt at Tracy City followed armed uprisings of thousands of miners the previous year in nearby Briceville and Coal Creek. Here, it is thought that the Knights of Labor leaders led miners to surround stockades, disarm guards, and release convicts onto Knoxville-bound trains over the course of several days. By August of 1892, hundreds of miners would confront state forces in armed shootouts across Grundy, Marion, and Anderson counties, releasing convicts when they could onto trains bound for Nashville. Miners were eventually arrested and convicted, but these revolts would lead the Tennessee General Assembly to end its convict lease system 4 years later, making them one of the first southern states to do so.
Well, they brought in the entire state militia. Heavy artillery and Gatling guns.
For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
The newspaper said they won a great victory. Handed out medals for their bravery. They got the convicts out of the mines.
According to a new report by The Guardian, local law enforcement and the FBI have been monitoring activists that oppose the natural gas pipeline project in Coos Bay. This includes collecting social media posts, rally announcements, and emails. The report shows that the agencies shared this information with Republican consultants that advocate for oil pipelines. These activists are fighting against the Jordan Cove Energy Project, which has proposed a 230-mile pipeline that would export 7.8 million tons of natural gas annually. The Trump administration has made the Jordan Cove project a priority due to the promise of local jobs and economic growth. However, opponents are concerned that it will damage the environment, disrespect indigenous rights, and devastate local communities in the event of natural disasters. Under Oregon law, police agencies are not allowed to monitor information about organizations unless it is related to possible criminal activity. A spokesperson for the agencies claimed that the activists are, quote, a potential danger and could be associated with possible criminal activity. However, the Oregon ACLU disagrees, stating, quote, monitoring and compiling information about Oregonians' political or social views, activities, or associations violates Oregon law.
This coming Saturday, the group known as Patriot Prayer, along with their allies, the Proud Boys, who have been designated by the Southern Poverty Law Center as a hate group, are planning a rally in downtown Portland. The rally is scheduled to begin at 11 a.m. at Waterfront Park. Other groups expected to attend are the white nationalist group The American Guard, along with extreme anti-government militias, the Three Percenters, and the Oath Keepers, as well as the neo-Nazi group The Daily Stormers. The main organizer of Saturday's rally is Joe Biggs, who is coming from Florida. Biggs has long been associated with neo-Nazi causes and has been described as a thug with the mentality of a schoolyard bully. Rose City Antifa will also attend to counter-demonstrate and are calling for local residents to turn out en masse to support them and bear witness to whatever actions may occur. This rally, which follows closely on the heels of the racially motivated shootings in El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio, has the potential to become extremely violent. Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler stated in an interview with local news station K2 that, quote, these people intend to come to the city of Portland on the 17th explicitly to commit acts of violence. Portland police are gearing up for violent clashes between the white nationalist groups and Antifa and have even enlisted aid from the Oregon State Police as well as the FBI.
In a new interview, Trump's top immigration official altered the wording of the famous poem written on the Statue of Liberty so that it aligns with the administration's newest immigration rules. Emma Lazarus's original work on the Statue of Liberty read, quote, give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to be free. The head of Citizenship and Immigration Services, Ken Cuccinelli, altered this poem in an interview, saying instead, quote, Give me your tired and your poor, who can stand on their own 2 feet, and who will not become a public charge. The alteration comes just one day after Cuccinelli announced a new requirement that would limit legal migrants from seeking public benefits like housing aid or food stamps.
Coordinated immigration raids in Mississippi last week resulted in the arrest of 680 workers, more than half of which are still in ICE custody. Two of the companies that were raided had also previously been subject to multiple investigations and lawsuits for labor violations involving their employees. One of the facilities raided last week was the Koch Foods plant in Morton, Mississippi. The plant had been subject to fines of more than $88,000 in 2016 for multiple workplace safety violations. In July of 2018, the company agreed to pay around $3 million to workers in Morton, resulting from a 2011 lawsuit in which the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission alleged that the company not only unfairly discriminated against employees based on sex, race, and national origin, but also subjected workers to retaliation for complaints, in some cases threatening workers with deportation. Despite having settled the matter out of court, Koch has officially denied any wrongdoing. Another of the companies that had been raided last week has also been the subject of frequent workplace safety investigations. In 2012, Pico Foods settled with employees for violating the Fair Labor Standards Act. The company was accused of denying workers overtime pay and requiring them to work off the clock in one of their Mississippi plants. Both companies are among the nation's largest producers of chicken, with customers including Burger King, Walmart, and Kroger Foods. Advocates for workers' rights fear that the recent raids in Mississippi will serve to deter employees from reporting labor violations, wage theft, and sexual harassment.
Today, President Trump told reporters he was delaying tariffs on Chinese imports to avoid conflict with U.S. shoppers during the holiday season. Trump said, quote, "We're doing this for the Christmas season." A U.S. trade representative said they would delay tariffs on goods until December 15th. The U.S. trade representative is also extending the import tax to everything China ships to the U.S. Electronics, including cell phones, laptops, and video game consoles, as well as some clothing, shoes, and toys, will be affected by the delay, meaning they will be cheaper before December 15th than after.
You have been listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast at 5:30 for Totality of Circumstances with KBOO's Sam Bowman and Jasmine Moneymaker. Then at 6, it's Preference. At 7 p.m., it's Calculated Conversation. The weather tonight will be clear with a low of 63 degrees, but tomorrow it will be mostly sunny with a high of 86 degrees. Today in history. In 1961, East German soldiers began laying down barbed wire and bricks as a barrier between Soviet-controlled East Berlin and the democratic western section of the city. The quote of the day is from ex-Chancellor of Germany, Gerhard Schröder, who said, quote, "The wall was brought down not by Washington or Moscow, but by courageous people."
A group of 29 states and cities have filed a joint lawsuit against the Trump administration in an attempt to block a new power plant rule, saying it fails to protect Americans from pollution and climate change. The coalition argues that the new rule violates Obama-era policies like the Clean Air Act, which set national limits on carbon emissions from power plants. Trump's replacement for the Clean Power Plan is the Affordable Clean Energy Rule, which ignores the Environmental Protection Agency's responsibility to limit greenhouse gases and instead extends the life of coal-burning plants. The lawsuit is the second of its kind against the rule, the first having been filed by the American Lung Association in July.
And now, from the Yale Center for Environmental Communication, it's Climate Connections. On today's episode, artist Xavier Cortada wants to get people talking about the problem of rising sea levels.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. As the ice sheets of Antarctica melt, seas are rising, threatening cities like Miami. For resident and artist Xavier Cortada, the reality sank in when he traveled to Antarctica.
I was horrified to understand that the very ice that I was standing on was the ice that threatened my city.
To get people back home talking about the problem, he started painting yard signs for people who live in his neighborhood. Each sign features a large, ornate number that indicates a home's elevation in feet. The numbers look like they're partially submerged in water, as many properties could be within decades. Participating homeowners meet monthly to talk about sea level rise and how to adapt. The group is called the Underwater Homeowners Association.
At the beginning, the people who were involved were the people who were most concerned.
But he says the signs have also helped raise awareness among people who previously did not worry about how climate change would affect them personally.
So now they're talking about the issue because they feel more vulnerable or more impacted by it, as opposed to something that felt like it was in a horizon far, far away.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
A new study by researchers at North Carolina State University has found that e-scooters generally produce more greenhouse gas emissions per mile than standard diesel buses with high ridership. The study looked at the entire life cycle of e-scooters, including production, shipping, charging, collection, distribution, and disposal, to calculate how they compare with other modes of transportation. The report found that around two-thirds of the time, scooters contribute more emissions per mile than other alternatives, such as high-volume busing, electric mopeds, electric biking, regular biking, and walking. However, cars still produce about twice the amount of carbon dioxide per mile compared to e-scooters. The study also calculated the average lifespan for a rental scooter, which came out to 28.8 days. Additionally, in a survey of Raleigh, North Carolina scooter riders, nearly half of all respondents said they would have biked, walked, taken a bus, or skipped the trip if scooters were not available. Data from the Portland Bureau of Transportation preliminary 2018 e-scooter findings report showed that the availability of e-scooters in the city did decrease car driving somewhat. However, the survey did not ask whether scooter riders would have used the other transit options if the scooters were not available. Protests in Hong Kong continue over the proposed law that would allow China to extradite people from Hong Kong. Many critics worry that China would use the bill to prosecute people for political reasons, essentially eroding the freedom of those in Hong Kong. As of now, the bill has been suspended but not withdrawn. Hong Kong International Airport has returned to normal operations following clashes between protesters and police. According to CNN, the airport had been cleaned up and political graffiti was covered with white sheets of paper. On Tuesday, five people were arrested and two police officers were injured during the protests. While the first days of the protests were all about the bill, the movement has expanded. Protesters are now demanding an investigation into police brutality and calling for greater democracy and major political reform.
According to the world's eighth largest bank, the oil economy is, quote, now in a relentless and irreversible decline. In a report entitled Wells, Wires, and Wheels, analysts at BNP Paribas Bank predicted a continued decline in the profitability of the oil industry due to advances in renewable energy and electric vehicles. BNP Paribas is based in France and operates in 77 countries. The report cited the dramatic decline in the cost of solar and wind power and batteries over the past decade as reasoning for the oil's decline. Additionally, there is an expectation that the efficiency of renewable resources will continue to improve and their prices will decline in coming years. Their analysis concluded that the cost of running electric vehicles is dropping so quickly that in a few years, the price of oil will need to drop to about $12 per barrel to be cost competitive. Currently, the price of oil per barrel is over $50. The report also determined that the oil industry's continued investment in finding and producing new oil was an enormous waste of money. the analysis concluded by stating, quote, "The economics of renewables are impossible for oil to compete with when looked at over the cycle. It's time for investors and governments to walk away from big oil before the crash and before it's simply too late to save our children and future generations from catastrophe."
Guatemalan conservative candidate Alejandro Giamatti was elected president on Sunday with a promise to change the unpopular migration deal with Washington, D.C. Giamatti wants to improve the deal that the former president made to halt U.S.-bound migration. The agreement between the two countries would make Guatemala a designated place for migrants to wait. Restrictions, bureaucracy, and secret addendums to the deal will effectively end the journey north for many migrants. Giamatti will not take office until January, and Guatemala will be under increased pressure from the deal in the meantime as more migrants seek refuge in the nation rather than in the United States. More than 200,000 Guatemalans have left the country since October 2018. Speaking about the current deal, Giamatti said, quote, "If we don't have the capacity to look after our own people, imagine what it will be like for foreigners."
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, August 13th, 2019. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Imara Moore, Alex Connor, Yasmin Kobanoglu, Al Khan, and Mackenzie Beard. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Liam Delta. The director of evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Leslie McLam.
And I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio. At 9, it's Radio Zine. Then at 10, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, the Dirtbag host, Glenn Anderson, welcomes guest Jim Gilbert to talk about new techniques in gardening. Don't forget that you can hear all of these programs after they air on kboo.fm or on iTunes and Google Play. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by members' support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate.
Thank you, everybody, for listening to the KBOO Evening News. My name is Sam Bowman, and this is Totality of Circumstances, a biweekly segment focusing on policing and the community response to policing from a holistic perspective. And my co-host is Jasmine Moneymaker. She is not here in person, but will be joining us in a purely audio form later in the show. Hello, Jasmine. We're going to start the show with the most recent meeting of the Citizen Review Committee, and then later on we'll hear an interview with a community member who sued the city of Portland after being mistreated by police at the Not My President's Day rally in 2017. But first, last Wednesday, August 7th, Portland's Citizen Review Committee, or CRC, heard an appeal of a police misconduct case. That isn't news in itself. It's why the committee exists, after all, except that this is the second appeal heard by the CRC this year. The CRC meets once a month under normal circumstances, so that's 12 meetings a year, and it hasn't heard an appeal at one of its meetings since February. This contrasts with the number of police misconduct cases handled by its parent agency, the City Auditor's Independent Police Review Division, or IPR, which received more than 400 complaints from community members in 2018. Before we get into the details of this month's appeal case, we should point out some basics about how the CRC does things, or more accurately, how it is allowed to do things. When the police or IPR do an investigation into a case, they gather evidence, and then they draw conclusions based on that evidence. A misconduct case is investigated either by IPR itself, or, in more cases, by the police's own internal affairs unit. The results of that investigation are then handed over to the supervisor of the officer who is the subject of the original complaint. And the supervisor, usually referred to as the RU or Responsible Unit Manager, issues findings on each of the allegations at issue in the complaint. That's a drastically simplified version, of course. Give me an hour one of these days, and we can get into the full tonnage of committees and reviews these cases can go through. But if the complainant decides to appeal the findings, the case goes before the CRC, which is an 11-member, all-volunteer citizen board, and you can go to their meetings every first Wednesday of every month. But the CRC can't gather evidence. All they can do is look at the evidence used by the Bureau to reach their findings and then decide if those findings could have been made by a reasonable person based on that evidence. Confused? Well, that's probably the best headspace to be in before we dive in. Only 5 CRC members were actually present this month, barely making quorum. Also present were a handful of community member observers, the appellant and her advocate, 2 Bureau members representing internal affairs, and one of those was Commander Jeff Bell, who we'll hear from. Every party to the case is officially anonymous, referred to only by a descriptor like appellant or Detective A or community member. Here is the appellant laying out the incident that prompted the complaint.
I live right up the street at the Portland Plaza. It's a pretty well-heeled community where half the people live other places. It's a pretty common practice for people to leave things that they're not using by the garbage pails for other people to take. They sit there for a day or so and then they get thrown away by housekeeping. Sometime in January, it was definitely on the cusp of the Christmas season, were 2 bags that were right next to the garbage pail outside of the elevator. I went to my car and I thought it was very strange, so I went back and I took the bags and I moved them across the quilt. So if someone had mistakenly left them by the garbage pail, they would be over by the wall where they could see them. They sat over there for 2 days. I took them in my trunk, gave them away, and took them to Goodwill. Didn't think another thing about it. All of a sudden, out of the blue, I get a phone call from Detective A, accusing me of breaking into my neighbor's vehicle and stealing their things. I almost dropped the phone. I was so shocked. He threatened me and repeatedly stated that there was overwhelming evidence that I had committed theft and broken into my neighbor's car. I knew this was untrue, but he spoke for long enough and gave me a chance to gather my thoughts. So I told him that I couldn't believe he was calling me over a neighborhood dispute, and then said that I was planning on speaking to an attorney. He scoffed at that, but I hung up on it anyway.
The appellant's allegations were that Detective A demonstrated favoritism, that he inappropriately contacted the appellant after she insisted he only contact her through her attorney, and that he was discourteous. All would be violations of Bureau policy if found true, but the RU manager exonerated the detective on all counts. The appellant elaborated on the favoritism allegation.
Detective A did not independently verify, interview, or investigate any of the complaint. In his internal affairs interview, Detective A states that he was only peripherally familiar with the community member who made the allegations against me, and yet Detective A's complete acceptance of the provided video and statement suggests a high level of trust, not professional objectivity.
She also described the measures she took to test what a cop could normally do in response to such a call.
I go in, I go up to the window, and I say, hypothetically, I want to report one of my neighbors for theft. I'd like to talk to the detective right now. I have yet to get past, I have the cards, and they say, oh, that's not how it works. You have to call the non-emergency number, and we'll send a patrol officer.
Commander Bell from Internal Affairs told the committee more details about the backstory of Detective A's relationship with the appellant's neighbor, who was referred to throughout simply as the community member.
His story is that 5 years ago, Detective A was assigned to investigate, and the quote is, a case that involved a manager in the condo tower entering people's units to take medications. And it said that he said that he worked with him on that case at that time. The victim said that he had the detective's number in his phone over that time and simply made a call to the detective when he decided to pursue this case criminally.
At this point, some of you may be wondering why this story is on the news. Fair enough. There is, however, some interesting background information to be gleaned from this story about how police deal with low-level complaints and what sort of community members get prompt service and why. Here's Bell again.
From the detective's perspective, they do some of these lower-level cases at the precinct. Typically, they don't get calls directly from folks. However, in this case, the explanation given by the detective, and this is something that matches my expectations for them, if they've had contact with somebody in the past and someone calls him directly, I suppose he had a couple of choices, and I think he did what I would have expected him to do. The community member in this case came to him and gave him a statement, gave him video evidence, gave him photographs, gave him pictures of text messages, all of which was sufficient evidence to establish probable cause that a crime had been committed. And so the detective had two choices at that point. The detective could have told the community member simply, you need to go call non-emergency, which I think is similar to what the appellant was told by the desk clerk at both Central and East Precinct. Or he had the choice to take what was essentially a complete criminal investigation on a silver platter.
Bell went on to address the appellant's allegation of discourtesy, even remarking that the detective's behavior by offering the appellant an opportunity to turn herself in and sort things out in private amounted to, quote, good customer service, unquote. And perhaps it was yet another case of citizens just not understanding the reasoning behind police decisions.
I obviously have concerns about the way my folks, my detectives, talk to people. I can't always control how people perceive that, but I can, and I do have some control over the way those messages are delivered, and I think the way he delivered this message, when he was handed basically a criminal case on a silver platter with a complainant, with this community member who wanted to press charges, I think he handled this in a way that was completely appropriate, very polite, and respectful to the appellant. So, unless you have any questions, that's how I came to exonerate him on all three of those. I think there's more evidence, much more likely than not, that the detective's actions were not in violation of policy.
Bell elaborates a little more in this exchange with CRC member Gianni Nami.
Had the community member not provided such extensive would you have expected the detective to conduct this investigation and interview that?
Just as a hypothetical, had the community member come to him and said, look, these statues were stolen out of my car, and that was his assertion, can I make a report? I have to, again, now we're talking about hypotheticals here, I would guess that this detective and most detectives would probably say, I hear what you're saying, can you call non-emergency so they can come out and they can take care of this? But, because my expectation would be that yes, you would review video records, that you would try to see if there were any witnesses, that sort of thing. But again, with the video and with the recordings of the phone call, the pictures of the text messages, the pictures of, the community member took pictures of, you know, samples of these bags and samples of the items and the boxes they were in and everything. I I don't know what else I would have expected him to do, honestly, in this case. But yes, had it just been, had he not provided all that information, yeah. Because we, I'll give you an example. We do get those calls where somebody says, this was stolen and I know my neighbor did it. We can't arrest somebody based off that. Even if we may, for instance, know that somebody did it, you have to have probable cause in order to make an arrest. Based on my review of the evidence of the criminal investigation, which was in this, that evidence, I think it was very objectively reasonable for him to have believed that a crime had been committed. And like I said, I don't know that there's a whole lot else here to tie up. So,
CRC member Vadim Mozirski asked the appellant about Commander Bell's assertion that by getting involved, the detective actually improved the appellant's situation by reducing the likelihood of a patrol officer taking the call, which would have likely resulted in an arrest at her apartment building rather than a conversation down at the precinct on the appellant's own time.
What is your view on the possible testimony here that they might have been actually, this detective was actually trying to make the situation easier for you rather than harder for you? Do you believe that, or do you have any qualms with that?
Well, just to be completely clear, I was never going to turn myself in, ever. He could have called 10 more times. I was never going to turn myself in. I considered it harassment. I had an attorney. My attorney, he's quoted in the summary that you have of this case on page 3, and he says, I'm not going to be involved now because she asked me to cut it off. But that if you do something further with this, you have to come back to me. And I deliberately told my attorney to disengage. I was forcing Detective A's hand. I was saying, come and get me. Bring somebody down to arrest me. Absolutely. Does that answer your question?
CRC member Julie Falk, who filled in for absent committee chair Kristen Malone, summed up the general feelings of the committee before they voted.
I can't help but think that this is a unique circumstance in a lot of respects. And even if potentially it wasn't favoritism being shown by the detective, that in the realm of people reaching out to the police to make a complaint and to ask for action to be taken, that this was an incredible display of the time and effort and help to in the service of this person's request to resolve a neighborhood dispute over some dog statues. So I think that, but for me, it was a learning experience to hear that this was actually good customer service that was being shown. Because this is not always the story we hear when people reach out to the police asking for their help with issues like this one.
The vote was eventually taken to unanimously uphold the Bureau's decision to exonerate the detective on all 3 counts. That is more the result of the committee's restrictive standard of review rather than their actual opinions, however. Opinions which did not find the detective's actions particularly egregious, but did find them to be, as Falk put it, unique. Others expressed surprise that the detective's actions were actually well within policy and accepted practice. Others expressed surprise that the detective's actions were actually well within policy and accepted practice. Committee member Hillary Houck put a finger on it, calling out the detective for verbalizing his potential bias towards richer citizens.
I was also surprised by that. Shocked that it was within the rules, and I wonder, based on some of the comments that he made, if it was because of where they lived. And I wonder, he mentioned something about, like, this isn't a Southeast drug house, and I wonder if someone who lived in a less nice neighborhood would have received this kind of service. I don't know if that was surprising to you at all when you were reading that comment really stuck out to me.
In case you missed what committee member Houck said there, she said that in his interview with Internal Affairs, the detective mentioned that this wasn't some Southeast drug house. So, the CRC meets on the first Wednesday of the month. So their next meeting will be on September 4th at 5:30 at City Hall. I'll see you there. Next up on the show, we have an interview conducted by my reporting partner on this show, Jasmine Moneymaker. Jasmine spoke last month with Charles Stubbs, who was a longtime Portland activist, and he was arrested along with about a dozen other people at the Not My President's Day rally on February 20th, 2017. Stubbs brought a lawsuit against the city with the help of the ACLU after he was arrested and refused his inhaler after pepper spray from the police triggered his asthma. He spoke with Jasmine last month after an arbitrator had ruled that police officers could not be disciplined, at least not administratively, over what happened on that day. Here's Jasmine now.
So can you tell us a little bit, Charles, about your background and how you came to be here today?
I'm going to keep it short. I've been an activist since the 90s, anti-war and pro-police accountability for many years.
So let's go back to the sort of the beginning of your case and the Not My President's Day rally. Can you set the scene for us a little bit and tell us what was going on that day and where you all were?
It was February 20th, 2017. I was at the Federal White Building on 3rd and Madison. The person of color, his name was Quanis Hayes, was shot and killed by the Portland Police Bureau, and we were in solidarity with the family. And not only that, it was also the main one was the protest was also for people that didn't like Trump after his inauguration.
And so it was out in front of City Hall, you said, correct?
No, the federal building. Not it was right next to the Justice Center, between 3rd and 4th and Madison.
Okay, so how did the protest start that day?
I showed up around 11. There was some chanting going on, like say his name, and people would say like Juanes Hayes. So it's just a pretty typical day for a protest. And toward 11:30, the rapid response team showed up and tried to apprehend me. And I was in a berm, and they fell on me trying to apprehend me.
So for people who aren't familiar with the term rapid response team, that would be essentially what people would see as the police coming in riot gear.
On the Suburban with the running boards. Hence, they will show up as quick as possible and start running after people.
So what was happening in the crowd at that point when rapid response showed up?
They were starting to yell, "I spooked." My goal was there to make sure like the kids and the seniors were safe, and like families with kids were safe, because there was bike cops that would use their bike as a ram. And I was behind a mom who had her child in her arms, and there was a bike cop. So I ended up cupping my hands like this, making sure that if the cop did hit her or try to knock her over, I would have caught her because the baby was in her hands.
And so you're holding your hands sort of out to the side in a protective barrier for the mom and child.
Correct.
How many people do you think were there at that time?
I think more than 100 that I know of. I know there could be more by the time random people did show up, but I kind of knew that there was maybe 100 or less there at the time.
And so other than the number of people that were there and where they were, was there anything happening that felt unsafe besides the police showing up? Was there any violence or?
It was pretty mellow. People were out in the street. I don't believe at that time that the announcement truck was saying, the penal codes for not, like, at that time. But it was really peaceful toward the end before I got taken down and arrested.
There's about 100 people outside of the Justice Center, people milling about the street, maybe a little bit, some chanting going on, but nothing out of the ordinary, really, for a peaceful Portland protest.
Not at that point, no. my role was like the equivalent to security. We call ourselves peace and safety. I was also part of Occupy Portland, and that's what I did, was peace and safety, to make sure the people in the camp were safe. So I forgot to mention that earlier, but that's another thing that I used to do during Occupy Portland.
And then the rapid response team or the riot police showed up on their, you said they came up on a Suburban, and they jumped off and...
And started running after the people that they were targeting to arrest, and I was one of them.
Okay. And what happened then?
I was actually taken down. I was running up a berm, because I didn't see them until they were like in my peripheral, and they were right on me, and it spooked. And then I ran and turned around and realized who they were, and that's when I kind of stopped and turned around, and that's when they kind of took me down. And they supposedly picked me up and put me on the street, but that wasn't true. There's video out there of me being dragged to the street. Then I was placed in flex cuffs as well. Other pictures show that I'm really in distress and kind of like confused after it all happened. It happened within like 10 to 11 seconds, so really quick. So I panicked still a little bit, but I knew I was okay after all the incident. But.
And were you ultimately arrested?
Yes, I was. Eventually, I was put in the van. I have asthma. They were putting another person that was sprayed with pepper spray in the van. I requested my inhaler, and I was told no, but they lied and said that there was a Detective Myers, Jeff Myers, who said that he ended up administering my inhaler when he didn't. I was told no when I requested it. And I'm not sure if I'm allowed to have it on me during transpo, because I have severe asthma, and I was told if I do, I'm allowed to have it. So I don't know how to look, but I've been trying to find what I can and can't have because of my asthma.
You were arrested and you were taken to the Multnomah County Detention Center, I assume? And what were the charges that they filed against you?
Supposedly it was impeding a police officer, failure to obey a peace officer is what it was, and failure to comply, I do believe, and I think there might be one more. I'm not sure, but those are the main two that I do remember.
So you mentioned that a detective, Jeff Myers, lied about providing you with an inhaler. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
At the time that I was in the van, I didn't even know he was there until I didn't know what he looked like until he showed up to the arbitration, which was I don't remember the date, but it was like last week, I do believe, sometime, and. I'm not happy that they're lying and said that he administered it when I would have known if he did or not. And I requested and I was denied my inhaler after requesting it. So they can say whatever they want, but I know what I asked and I know what I was told.
And your inhaler was in your bag or in your possessions at some point, so it was there, you just didn't have access
to it.
Yeah,
exactly. Mm-hmm. I was denied access to it.
And so you were arrested, you were taken to the Multnomah County Detention Center, you were charged with a couple of things, including failure to obey a police officer. Were those charges, were you ultimately arraigned on those charges? Did they get through that part of the process?
I didn't even know I was even, actually, I thought they were dropped, but recently I found out that I was found guilty and I owe a fine. How am I supposed to, I didn't even know I had a fine. I still wouldn't pay it, but I didn't even know I had it. Until during arbitration when we were going through the evidence and stuff like that, I wasn't even aware that I even had a fine to pay.
You weren't aware that you had a charge, so what, you were released at some point, and then that was the last you heard of it?
Yeah, exactly. So I thought they dropped the charges, and obviously I found out I think I owed a $250 fine I wasn't even aware of. So I'm going to fight that. I'm fighting everything through appeal.
Okay. So following this, you were released, and then it sounds like you started the process of trying to get some answers about being tackled and arrested to begin with. So how did that process start? What did you do?
I ended up filing a tort claim against the city, which led up to the lawsuit. I was seeking $10,000 for damages, which they said I had no physical, but what makes you think it's not just mental and emotional, too? Just because I didn't have physical scars doesn't mean I went through the mental and emotional. I did. I'm still thinking about needing to go to see a therapist for it. But it's hard because I don't trust him. But at the moment, it's either I go in or I don't. And if I don't, then it's, I might. It's just a hard thing because of all the situation that led up to court and everything like that. It did take a toll on my health for a while, too. So I'm not in it for the money. I'm in it for the for them to be held responsible for their actions. That's pretty much why I filed the lawsuit.
Can you tell us a little bit more about that process of filing the lawsuit and what has happened since then?
Process was finding an attorney, then ending up filing a brief, which means like just the case scenario of why there's the lawsuit. And then after that, we go through the evidence leading up to what's relevant, trying to find if they were at the wrong. And not only that, trying to find witnesses that could corroborate the story that they were really out of line. Let's see, picking like the trial date if it got to that far. So it was a very big process. I didn't make it to the trial yet. Just ended at arbitration, and after that, the rest is history. They sided with the city on their findings.
So that was Charles Stubbs, an activist who was speaking with Jasmine Moneymaker, my usual co-host on this show. Thank you, everybody, so much for listening to Totality of Circumstances this week. I'm going to do a quick little rundown of some events that are coming up that you may be interested in related to policing and the community oversight of police. So there will be something or other related to police at City Council, but it appears that too many of our city commissioners are out of town, so there is no City Council meeting either tomorrow or on Thursday. The PCEP, the Portland Committee on Community Engaged Policing, is going to have its general meeting later this month on the 27th at IRCO, the Immigrant and Refugee Community Organization, at 10301 Northeast Gleason. So that's Gleason and 103rd. And their subcommittees of the PCEP, which is kind of where the real nitty-gritty happens, they're having meetings throughout the month. On the 14th, the Settlement Agreement and Policy Committee will be meeting. On the 20th, the Subcommittee for People with Mental Illness. And on the 22nd, the Race, Ethnicity, and Other Subcommittee. There's also a Youth Subcommittee in there somewhere, and I believe they're meeting after the general meeting. So stay tuned for our next show. Also on the 21st of August, a Wednesday, at 10 a.m. at City Hall, there's a local node of the nationwide rally to hold police accountable. It is going to be hosted in part by Letha Winston, the mother of Patrick Kimmins, who was shot and killed by Portland police in September of last year. She is calling on the city to release the full-length video of the shooting of her son. The previous version, she says, was tampered with by the district attorney's office. On the 28th, also a Wednesday at 11 a.m., there is a Feet to the Fire campaign event at the Clackamas County Circuit Court at 807 Main Street in Oregon City. Feet to the Fire is a campaign to hold district attorneys accountable for their role in injustice and the lack of accountability for police officers. And again, that is at 11 a.m. on Wednesday, August 28th. Thank you, everybody, so much for listening to Totality of Circumstances this week. We will be back in 2 weeks at 5:30 on Tuesday. I'm Sam Bowman. You're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio station.
Give me an F! Tune in August 16th from noon till 4 p.m. for KBOO's celebration of Woodstock 50 years later, featuring previously unreleased music and more from the original festival tapes, plus recent interviews with the voices of participants and musicians who attended the festival, including Country Joe of Country Joe and the Fish and Jorma Kaukonen of the original Jefferson Airplane. That's August 16th starting at noon for KBOO's celebration of Woodstock 50 years later. Tune in.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Unity, a night of feminist Latinx BDX hip-hop, Tuesday, August 28th at 9 p.m. at the Dog for Lunch in Portland. Unity features artists Maria Advertencia Lirica from Oaxaca, Valentina Peralta from Chile, Portland's Kayla J, and DJ La Pausi. This event is also sponsored by Colectivo Ruda and Cup Hoop Creative. Again, la mula no era arisca, pero la hicieron. That's Unity, a night of feminist Latinx BDX hip-hop, Tuesday, August 28th at 9 p.m. at the Dog Fair Lounge, 830 E. Burnside Street in Portland. This is a 21 and over event. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under community events.
This is Preference. Welcome. Thanks for joining us here on the Cutie Boo slot. We are here as Preference every second and fourth Tuesday of the week. And there are other great shows covering trans issues that take the other weeks. So this is our Cutie Boo slot, and we're so happy to have you. We're going to run an older program. It's actually just from a few weeks ago. Some good stuff in it, but I wanted to make a couple of announcements first. First, thanks to Somia for making radio happen in the booth right now. Second, this week, actually today, August 13th, is an anniversary of sorts. August 13th, 1998 was the first time in over a decade that the week